change to the consideration and adoption of minutes. And any an announcement that we otherwise would be having. We should appreciate that we, on the 11th hour, if not 12th hour, we have the Department of Environment to us, having interacted with the Minister yesterday of Environment. She was quick to suggest that we should have. And perhaps also this being a lesson for all future engagements, all of them, on a matter that does not reside with us in terms of our own core competence, we have every right to invite any other department. We must not only confine to our department that we exercise oversight on. So this must be a lesson for us going forward, officials from the committee. Members, we have a very important briefing that directly affects the sector we are involved in, both water and sanitation. And whatever happens in those negotiations has a serious bearing on the area that we are actually involved in. So we shall then allow the Department of Environment as it is a lead department in this whole climate change negotiations and also activities in the country as well. And then we shall then take over from the Department of Water Sanitation. Okay, we find that. Okay, without some time, the Chief Director, I think you are the Chief Director. You shall then have to take us through the whole process. Thank you very much. Oh yeah, so just before that, do you have a presentation or do you want to be marking it? Is that yours?
No.
I'm asking whether you have a presentation.
Yes, we did the presentation and said it was given now.
Can we have the work environment one? Maybe before we do that, we do have a few apologies, members. The DG is not with us. And Mr. Ngoni, one of our members, is not with us today. And the minister is also not with us today. And also the deputy minister. He's not with us today. So the only apologies that we have. Okay, thanks. We trust that this session shall empower us going forward. We're not sure whether you also did include any presentation on the MDGs and SDGs. This is another area that we must take an interest in, and perhaps going forward we shall have to find time and incorporate it into our program. Thank you. You can go ahead in the meantime using whatever you are with, and then whilst whatever is being put up. Thank you, Honorable Chair Hashan. Good morning, Honorable Members, colleagues, members of the media. I'll be giving a brief presentation on international climate change, showing the linkages with water issues. I hope the Secretariat will be able to load the presentation as we move forward. The structure of my presentation, I'll briefly touch on the national context, then move straight into the international context, highlight the dynamics and the processes that are involved in the negotiations, and then take a step forward and look at the next coming COP, Conference of Parties under the United Nations Climate Convention on Climate Change, the next COP, which is in Lima this year, and briefly touch on the South Africa's position on this climate change. Fortunately, Chair, I do have trusted colleagues from the water and sanitation that I work with in the international negotiations. I must say we've been working for a long time with the colleagues. If I may just give a background, as a country, South Africa, we ratified the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change as far back as August 1997 and acceded to its Kyoto Protocol in 2002. The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or the UNFCCC as it's called, it's the body, the UN body, that deals with matters of negotiations for climate change. And up to now, we have about 194 countries participating in that UN body. And over and above the convention, we got what we call the Kyoto Protocol, which was a protocol under the convention meant to put forward concrete actions, particularly from the developed countries. The first such protocol, or the first commitment period under that protocol, was the 5-year cycle that ended in 2012, and we are now in the second cycle of that Kyoto Protocol that will end in 2020. As a country, we produced our first national climate change response policy as far back as 2004. And that first draft really put the issue of climate change in the minds and souls of many people in the country. And over time, we managed to make a point that climate change is viewed as a sustainable development issue. And honorable members will remember that in 2011, as a country, South Africa, we hosted one of the conference of the parties for this convention, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, right here in Durban. And at that time, we were at COP. It was COP 17. It was the 17th conference of parties. And it was in the lead to that conference in 2011 that we finally adopted what we call the National Climate Change Response Policy. This policy gives us guidance as a country on how to deal with the issues of climate change. And I want to emphasize here that the policy identifies water, agriculture and forestry, health, biodiversity and human settlement as some of the sectors that needed particular attention. So water is right there in the center of the National Climate Change Response Policy, which the Department of Environmental Affairs is coordinating throughout government. Now, just a little bit on the climate change impact on water. I know my colleagues from Water and Sanitation will go into details on this, but just to give a brief background on this, just one slide really. climate change impacts on water could exacerbate existing water-related challenges. I think that is a fact that is recognized in the policy. And climate change, as we have studied it, it creates new challenges related to climate variability, extreme weather events, and changing rainfall seasonality. This has got a huge implications for a wide range of economic sectors and livelihoods. It will have a devastating effect, particularly on development of infrastructure going into the future. We know very well the nexus between water and energy, and this is where the issue of development comes in. So if we do not deal with the issue of climate change, we will have serious problems going forward on issues of development. Projected impacts are due to changes in rainfall and evaporation rates and changing runoff across the country. And the Department of Environmental Affairs has done a long-term adaptation scenario planning, which tells us exactly what is going to be happening in the country. Some parts of the country will experience more rains, and some parts of the country will be dry. So under the weather future climate scenario, you will have excessive or increases in runoff that would result in flooding, human health risks, ecosystem disturbances, and aesthetic impacts. And we can see from the maps that the particularly provinces such as KwaZulu-Natal and some parts of southern Mpumalanga and Eastern Cape will be affected by this weather scenario. However, even in the prior future climate scenario, this will still result in reduced surface water availability. So climate change will have an impact throughout the country. And it is something that the water department is taking care of doing the planning, and we look forward to hear the plans from the colleagues from water. But now moving straight into the international arena, I've already said that the body, the United Nations body that is responsible there, is the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And the whole convention is based on science, and the scientific body that is responsible or that guides us in those negotiations is what we call the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or what is known as the IPCC. And currently, the IPCC is working on its fifth report, which is a five-year cycle report. And from what is coming out of that report, we can already see the impacts of climate change. And the report, the scientific body report, the IPCC report, actually highlights the fact that the impacts will be more severe than what we have thought previously. Now we can say with certainty about the impact and what impact we will have moving forward. So the scientific report cautions on that fact. And climate change presents more risk to the poor and most vulnerable countries. And this is so because of lack of adaptive capacities. We know our partners in the developed world have got money and resources to put to do adaptation measures that can alleviate this effect of climate change. But we will be highly impacted simply because of this poor adaptive capacity. So the poor will be hit first. Although climate change does not discriminate, it will hit all the poor and the rich, but the poor will be the ones who will suffer most and first. So the report, this fifth assessment report from the IPCC, it can indicate that between 75 and 250 million people in Africa alone are projected to be exposed to increased water stress. So the water issue is definitely there, highlighted in this report. About 250 million people from our continent will be subjected to this water stress.
increase of 5 to 8% of arid or semi-arid land in Africa is projected under a range of climate scenarios. So, honorable members can obviously see that what impact on what will be resulting from this climate change impact. The Horn of Africa is involved in this United Nations Framework Convention negotiation to seek a global solution to this global problem of climate change. But there are lots of dynamics in the negotiations, the dynamics that we have to navigate quite carefully to ensure that we can have a global response that will keep us safe. I'm sure honorable members have heard about the overall objective of the convention, the UNFCCC convention, which is to limit temperature increases to below 2 degrees centigrade. Because if we keep over, the consequences will disappear. Climate change is already happening, but if we pass that threshold, what we are experiencing now will look like nothing. It will be worse. So the convention seeks to limit this temperature increases to below 2 degrees centigrade. But why are we having these negotiations when we already signed up to this convention and its Kyoto Protocol? The big problem that we have is that under the Kyoto Protocol, which gives specific targets to developed countries, we have one major player or the leading polluter not being part of that, and that is the United States of America. So you're already sitting with a problem there. Other members such as Japan and Russia see the system as unfair, and they are therefore not participating in this second round of binding targets for developed countries, which is the second commitment of the Kyoto Protocol, and advocating for a new regime that will not only capture the United States, but also capture what are called emerging economies that include us. So they have said the system is unfair, and it gives the economic competitive advantage to those who have no comparable legal obligation. Therefore, the current climate change negotiations are driven by this changing world order and the rise of rapidly industrializing developing countries. That is just a brief context on as to why we continue to have these negotiations, even though we have all signed up to the convention. So the negotiations under the convention are geared towards the adoption of the new legal instrument in December 2015. Next year is the cut-off date for the new agreement under this UN convention. As I said, the so-called middle-income and key emerging countries are expected to assume greater responsibilities. So a country like South Africa is expected to assume greater responsibility than it did in the past. So this new agreement will bind all of us, including developing countries. Although the fight now is what will be the contribution from each one of us, we assert that it cannot be the same for developing countries and for developed countries. And we see this attempt to reclassify countries into rich, middle-income and low-income countries as something that poses a challenge to traditional regional groupings and alliances. As South Africa, we will continue to participate in our capacity as a member of the Africa Group and the Group of 77 in China. However, because there is a particular focus on the so-called middle-income countries, we coordinate our position as well with our fellow basic members, which is Brazil, China, India, and South Africa. So we do a lot of coordination amongst ourselves, the four of us, because there is a particular target towards the four of us. So over and above participating in the negotiations as an integral member of the Africa Group and the Group of 77 in China, we also coordinate our position as the four countries. And this is a slightly different to the BRICS. The BRICS include Russia, but in the climate change arena, Russia is classified as a developed country. So it is not a member of the basic, basically, it's just South Africa, India, China, and Brazil. And, honorable members, these negotiations involve a complex of issues, issues that seek to balance social, environmental, and political and economic issues. The main drive, really, as I've alluded, is to rebalance the current architecture where developed countries take legally binding commitments, whereas everybody else contributes their own fair share. And to address this, the negotiations started as far back as 2007 when we had what we call the Badr Roadmap that was meant to conclude in 2009 in Copenhagen. We all know the story for that. We could not conclude those negotiations successfully. We had the next COP in Mexico that tend to restore confidence in the negotiations. And shortly after Mexico, the Conference of Parties moved to South Africa, Durban. And it was in Durban where we launched what we call the Durban Urban platform for enhanced action. This is a platform aimed at constructing a new legal agreement that I talked to that is meant to be signed and concluded in 2015, next year in Paris. So Durban was a watershed moment, set specific milestones for the climate change negotiations. And following Durban, we had the Conference of Parties in Doha. Doha's mandate was to implement some of the Durban outcomes, because in Durban, that's where we also agreed about launching the Durban Platform for Enhanced Action, aimed at constructing a new regime, but we also agreed to extend the current setup where we entered into the second phase under the Kyoto Protocol. So we agreed to that, so the next COP in Doha, mandate was just to make sure we finalize all those issues and we can immediately start implementing from 2013 going into 2020, which is when the new regime will be kicking in. So when the second phase of the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2020, we are expected to enter or to start the new climate change regime, which would have been successfully concluded in 2015 in Paris. Whether we will conclude in Paris is another matter, but the new regime is expected to take effect from 2020. And last year, the Conference of Parties was held in Warsaw. Warsaw also made huge advances on the negotiations for startups. Under the Durban Platform for Enhanced Action, we were simply negotiating or trying to find each other, but it was really in Warsaw where we moved those negotiations into formal mode. So we managed to successfully do that transition from informal negotiations to a formal mode of negotiations, yet towards producing a negotiation text. As we speak, we do not yet have the negotiation text, although we are expected to conclude the negotiations next year in Paris based on the negotiation text. But also did the transition and gave the next COP, which is this year in Lima, a mandate to conclude the elements of that negotiation text. However, also went further. It also gave each one of us a homework to go back home and start national processes that can result in offers from each one of us. As I've said, the new climate change regime will capture all of us. So we've been given a mandate to go home this year and start national processes and put those offers by the first quarter of next year, in addition to concluding the negotiation texts. That should be good for 6 months if there is. So, as a country, we are also engaged in that process. It is formally called Internet Nationally Determined Contribution. But as I said, it's just a homework for all of us to go back home and see what can be my offer, what can I put forward to the international committee. So that is the process that was undertaken by Warsaw. And however, Warsaw was not so clear in terms of that national process homework as to what should be captured. And that mandate was then given to the province Lima to flesh out exactly what should be captured under that national homework. There's a big fight now because our partners, as you would have expected, expect us to put forward a contribution that is simply focused on mitigation, that is reducing this greenhouse gas that lead to climate change. However, we in the developing countries, because there's a historical perspective to these negotiations and to these effects of climate change, we will be faced with a situation where we need to adapt no matter what kind of an agreement do we reach. So we contend, we put it to them that the movement should not only be mitigation focused, but it should include our adaptation offers. And in the movement, we also want to hear from them what financial contributions are they going to put forward to enable us to do this mitigation and adaptation. So those dynamics would play out in the next COP in Lima. The COP in Warsaw was also very successful because we managed to agree to some guidelines on how to do national adaptation plans, and we also managed to raise money for the adaptation fund for that allows developing countries to do adaptation projects. We also fleshed out a lot of accounting and accounting rules for the Kyoto Protocol for the commitment period. So we were successful in that regard. Now, if I may look forward to Lima, we started the negotiations with a formal process in June. We will have a conference of parties in December in Lima. And in addition to this, we've had informal meetings. We started the year with one in Tokyo. And we, as Varalta, coordinating with our friends from Brazil, China, and India, we had our first basic meeting in India last month. The next one is scheduled to take place here in South Africa, and the last one will take place in China just to coordinate our positions. And ministers had a chance as well to meet and discuss through what we call dialogue in Germany, Berlin, this year. And the next stage will be the pre-COP in Venezuela in November this year. Another forum for ministers, the forum that has kept ministers busy is what we call the Major Economic Forum, which is led by the United States of America. We had our first meeting, or the ministers had their first meeting under the MEF in France in July, and the next one, which is the last one, will be in New York in September. And September is a very crucial month because Ban Ki-moon, that's also called a climate summit in New York, 23 September, for head of state to come and talk about climate change, to reconfirm their commitment to tackling the issue of climate change. So our president has confirmed that he will be attending together with our president, and at this climate summit called by Ban Ki-moon, head of state are expected to announce ambitious goals. There are various thematic areas where presidents are expected to sign up to. I think South Africa is participating in a number of those initiatives, including energy efficiency initiatives, the agriculture initiatives on climate-wise agriculture, and so forth and so forth. So our president will be confirming our participation in some of those events. However, the president will also be confirming that in South Africa, we will be sticking to the pledge that we made in Copenhagen. Because South Africa so far is the only country that made a pledge in 2009 that goes beyond 2020. We made a pledge that goes right up to 2025. So the president will also be confirming and assuring the international community that as a country we will fulfill that pledge. We are committed to making sure that we fulfill that pledge that we made in Copenhagen in 2009. So those are some of the things that the President will be putting forward under Ban Ki-moon Summit in September this year. In the margins of all these meetings that are intensive bilateral consultations among parties, we communicate on a daily or monthly basis with our partners that we would understand these are difficult issues and we need to find each other, and we are far away from finding each other. So we communicate, we try and keep in touch, not only as friends, but also with our partners. Now, if I may conclude with the process towards COP20, which will be taking place in Lima, I just want to sensitize honorable members that Lima is a critical phase in these negotiations. We have to agree to elements of a draft negotiation text in Lima. That is very crucial. If we do not do that, if we do not have political guidance as to what shape and form the new climate change regime should take, then we will find ourselves in a complicated situation where the political leadership came last moment to try and arm out a deal, and as we all know, that did not work out. So Lima is a critical moment this December. We have to find a political resolution that will give us the negotiators ample time to hammer out the technical details of such a deal. So Lima is a crucial moment indeed. Another political balance, as I already said, we will find that out from the UNFCCC summit. But what is our high position among all this? This seems to be a lot of information, a lot of engagement, but what is critical for South Africa? How do we engage in these negotiations? For us as a country, the position that we've always put forward is that the future agreement that we are negotiating, should respond to the development of science. Science is telling us where we need to be, at what time. So this agreement has to address that. As where we are now, we are far off the mark from what science is requiring. Science is telling us that we need to stay below 2 degrees centigrade by 2050, and we have to meet certain thresholds by 2020, and if we do the adding up, we can see the gap that exists. So our principal position is that whatever agreement that we agree to must respond to science. If it does not respond to science, we will not be safe, particularly us in this continent of Africa, which is warmer than any other part of the world. So already the 2 degrees centigrade that we are negotiating for Africa, that translates into 3.5 degrees, which is why we will still be impacted by this climate change effect. So the deal must respond to science. But the deal also needs to take into account developmental imperatives, in particular the priority given to poverty eradication by developing countries. It should have a clear co-benefit to participation. So we should build into this new agreement both developmental safeguards, that is no restriction on the efforts of developing countries to eradicate poverty, but at the same time also build environmental safeguards, that is an effective global response to climate change. So that balance should be there in the deal. We cannot be in a situation where the deal closes all the space for us to develop and alleviate people out of poverty. That is something that will not be favorable to all of us, and it will not take us forward. So those are the two critical points for us. And we think the new deal should put forward the sustainable development discourse and challenge any conceptual opposition between environmental integrity and economic development by maximizing economic opportunities, the cost benefits of investing in low carbon future. That is a pretty balanced, but can be achieved. The deal should be simple and flexible. So we should not find ourselves in the current situation where we keep on going back and negotiating after every 5 years. It should be flexible enough such that we can do tweaks to put a new commitment without going through intense negotiations that normally take time. It should be catalytic in nature, it be enabling, so that it can capture everybody, and the future agreement should be built on the current existing agreements. Every year at the conference of parties, we take a lot of decisions, but implementations of those decisions do not come forth. So the new agreement should build on the current agreements and fill in the gaps that exist that will enhance action to addressing climate change challenges. And from the South African perspective, we think it should be a legally binding protocol. There's no agreement on this point. There are three options that are on the table: protocol, another agreement, and an agreement that has equal legal force. The meaning of those are not quite clear. We all know what a protocol is, so our position is that it should be a protocol. However, a protocol is not an end itself. As long as the deal is legal and rigorous and tick all the boxes, we are fine. But as a country, we think the protocol is the most assured way to go. The deal should contain a binding absolute emission reduction target for developed countries and give flexibility to developing countries. However, we are not in agreement with an attempt that we are seeing, particularly from our partners, where they're pushing us into a situation where we will all have to take same targets, both in terms of stringency, the form, and magnitude. We think we should maintain the differentiation between developing and developed countries. For them, it should be absolute quantified emission reduction targets, and for us, it should be nationally appropriate mitigation commitments. But those should also be ambitious. So we should still keep the firewall between the developing countries and the developed countries, although we are all bound within the same legal argument that has got equal legal force to all of us. And what has happened in the current arrangement is that we see that the issue of mitigation or reducing these greenhouse gases is taking center stage and neglecting the issue of adaptation, which is very important to a country like South Africa and to a continent like Africa. So there should be that balance between adaptation and mitigation as far as we are concerned. And we think this should be eventually an adaptation agreement from our perspective, because that is what will keep us safe. And that is the position that we will be taking forward to Lima, and that is the position that we will be taking forward to Paris, where we expect this agreement to be concluded. But I do not want to give an impression that this is a busy negotiation. It is a tough negotiation that requires a lot of political guidance, that requires a lot of diplomacy, but hopefully we will get there. We are still debating the issue of how strongly do we want this agreement at what cost, because what we are seeing, a new dynamic that is coming up in this negotiation, is this pushback from the United States of America. All these negotiations are centered around trying to capture the U.S. into this agreement, but the attempt that we are seeing from the United States of America is to collapse these negotiations to the lowest common denominator, where the U.S. will do what South Africa can do. And that situation is not desirable because it will not add up to what science is required. We think they should be leading. However, that position from the U.S. is trying to find traction. Even from our partners, there are many countries that are starting to gravitate towards that U.S. proposal. But as Africa, as a continent, falls onto the lowest common denominator, where we end up with a regime that has no legal consequences, that has no ambitious targets, but those are some of the aspects that we are dealing with in the negotiations. And we are getting a lot of support from our ministers, we are getting a lot of support from our president, but it's going to be tough, and that is the position that we will put forward as a country. And Honorable Chair, I just want to thank you and end it right here. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Member, I propose that you don't waste time and allow the Department of Water and Sanitation to come through, and then we take one set of questions after the program presented. How we find that? Thank you.
Talk impacts and implications to situate it in the essence of our we now putting impacts related to climate variability? Are we now talking impacts to weather variability? Or are we then talking impacts related to climate change? So when we look at climate change in its context, basically, we are looking at an impact which is attributed directly or indirectly to human activity. When you put an impact into the climate system, you will get, for example, people will tell you climate has always changed as far back as the dinosaurs. That was climate change. Yes, it is acceptable. But in this context, as the colleague from Environmental Affairs already explained, here we are talking a change of the climate system that is purely attributed to humans. That's what we call an anthropogenic change. And that is why it is the situation becomes very important to contextualize at international level, SCD, that the carbon dioxide that is defining the change in the climate system is a global impact. It's all the industrialized countries that are emitting. Therefore, it becomes important to contextualize it at a global level, because the 2 degrees we're talking about and the 2.5 degrees for Africa that we are talking about is a change within the system that is not necessarily a result, for example, of the African country, but because we are vulnerable, we get a series of impacts that are done by other countries in terms of polluting the atmospheric system. Then we get into climate variability, which is looking at the change, basically, of your climate within a certain period of time. It's also important for us to emphasize the issue of time, because sometimes when we're looking at climate change, we're talking about a certain period of time, like a decade, and that would be, for example, a period of 10 years, and we start to compare these periods to the previous 10 years that we had. But with variability, we're talking over a series of a year. When we start to look, for example, how have been our rainfalls within this year? How has our season, our summer season been during this year? And then we start to look at that, okay, within this season, for example, the summer season, we got more rains in the Eastern Cape. We got more drying in the Western Cape. And that is the variability. Sometimes we find it as seasonal variability. Then we go on to the weather variability. Now, this is very important. You, for example, might get a person who says, in Cape Town, the weather changes 5 times a day. That is quite a crucial definition. It is not climate change. Therefore, we start by looking through these definitions to start to say, if you are sitting in a desk at Waterhouse trying to be some of your way, how do you start to apply this definition and distinguishing what is the actual change and what is weather variability? That slide is trying to illustrate again what my colleague from Environmental Affairs was saying in terms of the increasing trend within carbon dioxide, that is a human-induced part of climate change. If you look at that pink line, that increase over, I'm not sure if that slide is like it, between 1980 and 2010, you can actually see a global trend and a very drastic one in terms of an increase in carbon dioxide. This is one of the issues that is causing the negotiations within the international context to be very, very stringent and to have a lot of fight about who is now going to commit within the next commitment period. Because in essence, what it means is that if that line continues to go up and go up, the 2-degree global average that we are talking about is going to be even more of a possibility, even maybe not 2 degrees. Some push average gains up to a global average of 6-degree increase within the next 40 years in temperature, if that line continues like that. So basically, when we start to look at this human-induced climate change, we are looking at that line basically going up and up instead of it starting to come down, which is what the convention, the United Nations Framework Convention, is trying to do, in essence, the Kyoto Protocol and what is currently being negotiated now. The whole aim is centered about trying to get that line to start to slump down and to decrease in absolute terms. And the easiest way to do that is to get countries to start committing to changing their policy in terms of trying to reduce carbon dioxide. Now, let me try to define and give a bit of context. What does this mean in terms of the impacts themselves? If we look at climate change, basically, we do expect that if the 2 degrees, 3.5 degrees haven't, or we get more rainfall, there will be certain impacts, and those impacts basically are bound to affect the natural system, that is your natural environment as a whole, your rivers, your ecosystems, your forests, your grasslands, and then as well human life as you know it. In other words, once we start to realize the actual impacts of climate change, life as we know it will no longer be as we know it. If, for example, we get more rains, less rains, erratic rains, we can no longer define our seasons with what seasonal shifts. So a person who's sitting behind a desk trying to plan, let's talk integrated water planning and water affairs, that impact becomes a reality because we are then trying to put a policy and trying to prepare ourselves for something that we are not sure because our seasons are shifting. So that is a climate change impact that we need to start working upon. But then get what we call a potential impact as well. Now, that impact, we need to distinguish it again from a climate change impact because a potential impact is an impact that you don't get because you are anticipating change. By mere act of anticipating change, you know there is a potential impact, and then how can you start to cater for that potential impact before you can actually get it realized? That's when now we start talking about adaptation. When Chris gets into the presentation, you will see how our policies now are starting to get into grips with the adaptation issues for the whole country, the whole water sector. Then we get to the issue of residual impacts. Now, even if you do implement certain adaptive measures and you try to get everybody to be resilient, so to speak, or to be able to withstand the climate change effects, there's always that impact that you don't know. Coming to the water sector, as I was saying in the last slide, there's always that impact that you are not able to know until it happens, the residual impact. But if we were to, for example, contextualize what a residual impact could be like, if you look at some of the projections that we have that are showing us that as a result of climate change, we are likely to be looking at extreme events. Our floods are going to be more frequent, and the magnitude of these floods are going to be even worse. In other words, we are going to start to see floods with flood lines that are not necessarily defined. So if we are used to, for example, flooding in the Yangtze River going on a certain boundary, we are going to start to see now a flood that goes that boundary. That's the change in the flood line. And these are the things that we need to sit, judge carefully, and we try and then say what could be a possible adaptive measure here, and we try and work within that context. The second thing is, as we've been talking, again, that the increase or the decrease in global average temperatures is what drives the whole change. And if you look at the change in the global average temperature, whether it's an increase or a decrease, it is likely to have an impact on all the hydrological drivers. Now, for water, as we've shown there, if your global temperature increases, already you get stressed because you know. If we are talking temperatures now that are sitting at a global average of about 0.2 rise a year, in 10 years we are looking at exactly 1 degree average global temperature rise. It's putting stress on your temperature. If your temperature now rises, then that means your evaporation gets affected. So your rainfall as well. as much as in other instances you might say we've got better rainfalls, but as much as we've got better rainfalls, we've got very high evaporation rates. So we need to start to balance these things and try to understand what does it mean for the water sector. Same thing with our runoff. It's underplayed. And if you've got your high evaporation rates, what does it mean for groundwater, for example? What does it mean for our groundwater recharge? These are some of the things that we need to bring in the table and start to think about when you start to think of the wider impact that climate change will bring for us. So when we're talking, two things that are important here. When talking climate change in the context of the water sector, we are worried about changes in temperature, which we know already that is recorded, it is happening. Our temperature is rising. Secondly, we are talking of rainfall. How is our rainfall? Because that worries us as well in the water sector. Is our rainfall changing for the better? Is our rainfall changing for the worse? This is why we start to look at what we call climate change projections. We are working with a lot of academic institutions in South Africa to try and understand this project change for South Africa. And once we understand the project change, we are then able to say, okay, we know that by 2030, the rainfall shifting would have been like this. The rainfall trends would have gone northwards. The Western Cape, for example, is going to be having a lot of rain that are likely to be stronger by moving eastward. This is what the projections tell us. But with the rainfall, I must say the projections are not perfect. It's what we normally refer to as uncertainty. So as much as we've got these projections, they are not telling us something very definite. But we are able to use them time and time again, because the model keeps on changing, to say, okay, this model this year gave us these results, following year this, and we still continue saying, as long as this model is showing us an increase in temperature, therefore there's a high possibility that we must focus on temperature change. So these are some of the decisions that we try within the context of taking science and translating it into now policy, and how do we then start to use that within the water sector and say, okay, if the global temperature or our average temperature in South Africa is rising by this much, then we should be careful, because are we ready? Are our dams ready, for example? What if we want to build the next dam? How do we start to collect this and put it into action? That is, for example, an example of comparing Africa with the rest of the world in terms of surface water. Now, when you start to talk evaporation rate, that yellow part, you can see for Africa is at 80%. The green part that's low is at 20%, and your green part is your actual runoff. Now, we know already that if we talk South Africa specifically, we are rated as the 3rd driest country in the world. And if you look at those evaporation rates, which are very high, in other words, we are losing more to evaporation than we actually have on the surface runoff. And you compare this with what John was saying of the global average temperature change of 3.6, 3.5 degrees that we see. Already, that shows us that our water, surface water, is already allocated. Because out of the little water we have, we are already threatened by rising evaporation rates, of which already we know we already have a rising evaporation rate. So that map is usually useful because it demonstrates the kind of stress that we are likely to go through with this increased temperature rise of the atmospheric system. And if that continues, therefore, what we need to have in place, because in a natural system, we really we cannot do anything about it except reduce emissions. But if we start to look at certain adaptation measures that we can start to implement now, how do we then start, not necessarily to reverse the trend, but to protect our water resources in a way that we are sustainable throughout this period? Now, this is why within the negotiations, the international context, we are talking in this new agreement that is coming, that adaptation to be part of that legal agreement, because then through that process we are able to be assisted, for example, in terms of capacity building by the developed countries, finance, technologies. They must assist us with technologies that are going to address that. They must assist us with capacity building on how we start to prepare the country, our people on the ground, new technologies. They must assist us with all those things so that we know that as much as we are under threat, we are starting to implement measures with the assistance of the international community, with the assistance of national policies. So that slide is quite important if we look at it in this context, that within the next 20 years, we might be looking at global average temperature rise of 3.5 within the African continent. And that is not currently putting us in a nice, and I'm speaking in the context of Africa as a whole, not necessarily South Africa, because for South Africa, projections are showing us something very, very interesting. Let's go to the next slide. Now, before I get to South Africa, if you look at that, that's fine. What's important is the scale there. We're trying to, as the department, balance supply and demand. In other words, we must have enough water to supply our people, be able to supply as much as you have. But in the context of doing that, we've got other issues that we normally refer to as multiple stressors. As much as climate change is there, it is not operating in a vacuum. There are other issues that need to be in place such that certain things assist us in getting our adaptation strategies going and in trying to deal with the climate change impacts themselves. So, for example, if we look at the change in water demand, the demand is not necessarily stable. It will change, but what does that mean with supply in the context of climate change? We've got social setups, new policies, and not to mention the rising cost, because that's another important thing. For example, the price of building a dam now must not be the same as chances are it's going to rise. Even the issue, the very same issue of the amount of water coming out of your dam at home, that pricing is on. It's likely to change. Why? Because there is a change in the pressure of itself, which is not necessarily because of climate change, but other things that are putting the pressure on the changing price. So having looked at those stressors, what we call the multiple stress qualities, it already says that on top of all of these that are facing society, you still have climate change that puts even more pressure. But the main aim of the policy, we are trying to create a situation where we will always balance our supply, what we have, with the demand that is the amount that is required. Well, earlier on I referred to changes in projections. Sorry, let me just do this. If we look at this, this is what we refer to as the hydroclimatic zones. In other words, these zones have been designed in a way where we looking at certain hydrological characteristics of water and rain content in a certain area, and demarcating that area. So what you see there, if you look at the hydroclimatic zones, and these are also defined according to impacts basically. When you look at that zone, zone 6 there, that is the winter rainfall area. When you look at that area, that is the summer rainfall area. The area in the north there is also the summer rainfall area. But what is interesting is that this area gets fed by rain from here. In other words, the low pressure system that always comes here will always go through that. And it will normally dissipate around the Swaziland. But then you get areas that are fed by the Mozambique current on this side in terms of rainfall. But you will always get also your dry areas there, your zone 4 and your zone 3, which normally don't have a rainfall trend, but they are fed by the to look in terms of impact that this does on water. That watering pond area, in terms of protection, is protected to dry, it's going to dry. But this area is going to get wet. That is zone 5 and zone 2. And that area zone 1, they are likely to get wet. Zone 4 is going to also tend to dry even more. And zone 3. Now, what currently we are busy with is to try to zoom in each zone and try to understand intricately if we were to model what is going to be an analysis, a recent vulnerability analysis of these zones. Zone 1, for example, we've got a specific interest there because that is a transboundary zone. We got what we call shared water courses with other countries. So it's quite important for us to understand what the implications of climate change would be in that area. Zone 6 is a drying zone. As much as it gets rains, rains tend to sweep through and move towards Zone 5 in the Eastern Cape and Natal. But what does it mean, it mean for this area? But also the characteristics of this area. It's quite a porous area where there's a lot of runoff and all those sort of things. The studies that we are currently busy with now are trying to zoom in into understanding the potential impact of climate change within these water zones. And from there, we are going to try and put in adaptation measures in each zone because each zone has a specific characteristic that is different from the next one. This is my last slide. Here, what we're basically trying to say is that having studied this and trying to study more and trying to understand the science with the help of researchers, of course, like the Water Research Commission and the academic institutions, how do we then start to bridge the gap between this science and this emerging science, and we look at our policies and try to produce a strategy that would be workable within the context of science. I will leave it here, Honorable Members, and my colleague, Dr. Michelle here, will try and put in the policy context to it.
One thing I can tell you, Dr. Michelle, is not going to follow the two examples of having been too long to the point of you listening to the facts.
Chair, Honourable Members, my DDGs and my colleagues from here, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to talk through actually Markedly National and the Department of Water and Sanitation, say in terms of our strategy, because fortunately my colleague from BIS covered the international aspect, so I shall not repeat what he actually talked to. But suffice to say, in terms of the international aspect, the Department of Water and Sanitation, as my colleague indicated, is represented in the Department of Environmental Lead team of negotiators at the UNF Partnership, and we look at the water issues. For example, the Nairobi Work Program is about water, straight into data, information, and water. The research, as well as the aspects that talk to how you use satellite tools to manage your water resources in an integrated manner. So we also part of the team. Secondly, to again reiterate what the other said previously, that when we negotiate about mitigation. In other words, what do you do about emission? How do you reduce emission on one hand? And we also negotiate about adaptation. How do you respond to ensure that you cope with the impact, you become resilient? Water is about adaptation. Water is about looking at those communities that are hard hit
terms of the climate change. So if you can go through this again, let's stop there. Now, in response to what the Department of Environment called through the water policy for every sector to develop their own response strategy, in other words, to develop a strategy on how they are going to respond to the changing climate, the Department of Water and Sanitation has developed a strategy. Now, this strategy is aligned to the SADC strategy for climate change and water strategies because we share our water with our neighbors. We cannot live in isolation. The National Development Plan recognizes climate change as a major challenge, of course. And also, the National Climate Change Policy that we're talking about recognizes that sectors of effect need to develop their own adaptation strategy. If you look at our current version of the National Water Resource Strategy, NWRS2, it has dedicated the entire chapter 10 to water-related climate issues. Next slide. Now, the vision here is about how, as the Department of Water and Sanitation, or as a sector, let me put it that way. How do we appropriately respond to the changing climate and ensure that the limited water that we have is able to sustain us into the future? And also, how do we maintain the climate change research outcomes and other strategies into the way that we do? Because we have a National Water Act, which guide us, but how do you ensure that if you do this part, you ensure that you take account of the climate issues? Now, Chair, this slide is showing you, it's just indicating the strategy that we have developed, in other words, the water strategy that we have developed. There has been an inspection phase, and through the status quo assessment, inspection is a restart. The status quo is where we look and say, where are we as a country in terms of adaptation process that has been finalized. Now we are continuing with the consultation process. As we speak, we have been to the Northern Cape, the Northwest, Limpopo, Gauteng, KZN, Eastern Cape, and West Cape. We will be talking to the Free State and Mpumalanga before the end of this month. And then, at the end of the year, we will be completing the task. Of course, we also will be talking to the sectors, the key sectors such as the environment, such as, for example, health, such as agriculture. Next slide. Now, just to briefly share, the first thing that you want to do, when you want to assist, it can be a system or a rural community, is to undertake what is called vulnerability assessment. Because the intent is to reduce the vulnerability or the susceptibility or the susceptibility or the extent to which they are actually vulnerable. Say the next slide, please. To enhance resilience. And when you do this, focusing on the group that are most at risk, we have to consider the context. In other words, you don't just come with your science and your pride. You look at how the communities have been adapted, because there is indigenous knowledge there that you have to take along. And this assists in people buying in into the process. Improve your water resources management, such as, for example, ensuring that there's an enhanced water conservation and demand management. Of course, even though we want to, of course, we do have to adapt to the climate change, it's very important for us to preserve what we currently have and look after it. And then, of course, the strategy says we have to integrate the climate change considerations into short-term, into medium-term, and into long-term plans. Short to medium-term could be, for example, where you implement the artificial reserves of groundwater, like we have done in Vladimir Bay and Prince Albert Tree Department, to say you will have this water, for example, in areas where you place most, we take this water and store it underground so that you can use it later or in future. And of course, in the long term, you might consider building a scheme and so on. It is very important that we need to implement the best catchment management practices, learning from what the international communities are doing, learning from what works elsewhere, not just looking with the South Africa, of course, also learning from our rural communities. One would be surprised on how much you can learn from them, because they have their way of doing things, and maybe you just assist them so that you can delay getting into a tipping point. Another thing which is important is to enhance yields, institutional issues, and adequate monitoring, cross monitoring, underpins everything that we do. The next slide. And of course, the governance issues are also important here. The infrastructure development, the integrated water resource management, monitoring and evaluation, and of course, research and investigation. For instance, in a rural village, you may find that there is a borehole that has run out of water. We say run out of water, but it might not have run out of water. Water may still be there. It might be that your borehole is stopped because of maybe iron bacteria or some final particles. So we have to research and look into these things and see how we flush it out and that the borehole works again. It's like that. Chair, this is the end of my presentation. Sorry for being too long, but thank you.
Number Scott is a addressing if I were also to mention that this process also helps to assist us as we do our daily work. I'm tempted also, members, to say that as these negotiations take place on UNFCCC, whoever they are, as members of parliament, we also are presented with such opportunities. But when you go to those meetings out there, you see each increase in Peru, so also that means that we shall have to be prepared and also knowing exactly what it is that we shall be doing wherever. Our role as members of parliament, when a number of these conventions are negotiated out there, largely by the executive, we come back to parliament for ratification and endorsement. And in most cases, we find ourselves having to endorse things that we have no clue of. So this then becomes one of those opportunities that assist us in really getting a sense of what really is the content of what is being negotiated out there. And unfortunately, departments are susceptible to go out there all by themselves and leave all of us behind. And yet at the end, they shall be coming back to us, almost begging us towards their deadlines that they need to meet, and we need to be endorsing and ratifying whatever conventions that they shall have been negotiating. So that's background also for us to get a sense of understanding of why we are engaging in this briefing session. It may not be the last briefing session. There are 10 programs, organizations like AWEPA, among others, UNDP, they do assist us, empower us, about our own role as members of parliament, as we exercise our time, the work of the executive. One other thing that has been missed, which we discussed at some point, as those involved in other structures, again, as I say, to determine change,
is that we really need at some point, in fact, we were supposed to have in practice, so that we don't only just talk about things that happen out there, negotiation and so on. When we say we need to be part of a process of reduction of gas emissions, what do we do ourselves as members of parliament? Our own buildings here, the bulbs that are here, they're not friendly, your LED lights, so to speak. By now, we suppose as a parliament, we're supposed to have been having, you know, all these energy savings, smart energy, so that we don't only just talk, we also walk the talk. I had thought also from environment affairs, we shall also be getting a sense of, when we say by 2020, emissions shall have been reduced to this much, rolling it backwards, so that we quantify that achievement then, today, as in what then happens next year, what achievement shall we have been making in the coming year, in the runner towards that 2020. Because that's what also, if you have got us helping with the Millennium Development Goals, though we shall have made so much progress, especially from water and sanitation point of view, but also having to be able to say, you don't wake up 2014, 2013, because by 2015, this target shall have been met, a number of them. Though we, as I say, we had made serious progress in this regard. But you don't wake up 2 years before, 1 year before. What happens next year in the run-up to us? So that we're able to quantify yearly and bring you to account that next year you shall be able to achieve the target for next year. So that we are able to say to ourselves, indeed, we are playing our oversight role as members of parliament. Members, those are the briefings that we got from this department, both the environment and also water and sanitation. Any questions, comments?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a question to the department. As we know, the trend is, or we see now the trend is that we will be getting into a sort of shortage of water. My question is that shouldn't we up our plans, building more dams, making more money available to build, get in our catchment areas, dams and ponds so that areas we will have shortages. Can I get comments just on that issue, please?
Any other questions? Oh,
thank you, Chairperson. Linking my question to what has been asked already, those areas that do not have water now, which envisage shortage of water, are you seeing the situation where those who don't have will ever remain not having water because of the shortage? And the second one is, when you think of policies and, that you want to put in place to meet the shortage of water, what do you have in areas where you have rights to water given to certain individuals, also to nations? I'll give you an example. If you take what you call Pomala Puar Dam, or Jolik Dam, you have Mozambique, you have Swaziland, and of course ourselves, South Africa. They have rights on that dam
Thank you, Chair. You know, maybe just for clarity and to put me on the pitch, I'm not clear what are the reasons that made the U.S. not, fail to participate in that agreement. Just need to get the result and see that there is that South Africa or will do something to basically or influence the same kind to participate. What are the reasons behind their refusal for all these years to participate in that program? Thank you.
Thanks. I think the issue that I wanted to raise, Honorable Shilan has raised it, but I want to expand it. I just want to understand, going forward to the negotiations in December, United States has the biggest hold. If it continues not to commit to the negotiations, what are the implications thereof?
Ngoba sisibone lapho bhalayo uthole ukuthi kufikele zimfundo ezisibizwa ngey'khukhula zabulala abantu ukuze zangena emzini abantu. Ngiyabonga.
My is a very short one in relation to the comment that I was making. Come 2015, it's a new cut off date for agreements, legally binding agreements. We've been attending from your 2000 when the first meeting took place. We are now at this point where a new deadline has been set. What has before given felt that there are a number of other countries that are not coming on board. US being the leader, and there are a few other countries. If I were also to ask you specifics about this, you might make comment on China. Being your second largest popular polluter. What's the expectation of that?
Let me take the difficult questions first. And the difficult question is the one that has just been asked. What happens in 2015? That's a very difficult question to tackle. And it's a question we really need to ask to at the United Nations meetings, especially the one that will be held in September, to say, what do we do if America doesn't want to come to the party? That question will be asked. And the whole world should unite and ask that question very strongly. What happens in countries like Canada that we drew from the Kyoto Protocol? Because if for us to craft an effective international climate agreement, we must make sure that there are no free riders. In other words, America, Canada, any other country that is polluting must come to the party. And obviously we too would like to see our country developing so we can employ more people in factories and everything. So we must all come to the party and agree on this matter. So yeah, that question is very important to understand. I don't know if we have the answer to it. The question by Honorable Balindela on training of children. I have previously answered the question to say there are various training mechanisms in this country that are extremely good in terms of the amount of money and the number of people that we are reducing. In what has affected itself, I have said that we have about 640 million that we spend on an academy for training and getting engineers and scientists into the department. I know that we have absorbed almost 104 of these graduates in the department, and we hire them as soon as we finish training them. The amount that Parliament gives to the education departments for children to study at universities amounts into billions of dollars for less fast and other things. So the training of people, I think, should take place, and I think that it is taking place, but I think that we need to insist that more and more of our children should study science-related fields at school. We should encourage them to do that. But the amount of money spent in this regard is a lot of money that is spent in training people. It may not be as sufficient as we would all like to be, but it's billions and billions of us that is spent educating the country. The question of whether we should be building bridges in areas that are going to flood or not, I think that's a matter that we will have to come back to the committee about, because it's a matter that we have to consult public works and consult other departments and
and other people to see how we can offset the problems that come about because of flooding and changes in the climate. The question by Mr. Dawson on whether we're getting to a shortage of water and should we be building more dams, I do not know if the NWA out of our division has actually presented their APP this year. I think we did when we were here to say that there are areas where we're building dams, the Mzimvuru Dam that we want to start building, there is the raising of the Hazelmere Dam, or there is, we're doing many projects on dams. And it is in the APP that we presented. We are waiting on a new one because we will now combine this water and sanitation, and we will come back to the portfolio committee to give information on those areas. But we are looking into those issues. The important thing here again is to note that we would have to be strategic now in these issues. There may be, as you saw on the map that was shown, there may be other areas that may be going to get by and all that. So there's going to be a need for a lot of new building for the future. But at this stage, there are a number of them that were built to make sure that they're there. The important thing here, which my colleagues and I haven't really discussed for. What we need to discuss is how do we supplement with groundwater in those areas where we may not have sufficient water, where we still have groundwater. And what we would like to ask members of the portfolio committee is in the areas where you go, to really plead with people not to vandalize our boreholes. We build, we repair, municipalities repair these boreholes and we allow floods to vandalize them and somehow we need to find a solution to this problem. And it's a problem, I think, that as members of parliament you may want to raise in the communities where we come from. Maybe I should ask my colleagues to take some of the questions. Yeah? Any takers?
I would like to supplement the responses from my colleague. The first one that I would like to start with is on the areas that currently don't have water. All efforts at the moment are focused at those areas. We're looking at groundwater exploration, as the colleagues have said. We have programs on monitoring and operations. As we are aware that most of our problems are as a result of aging infrastructure. So there is concerted effort towards that. We also, as we are aware, that in the past we had to be used to build dams or dams that are for single use, like for example, agriculture. We have a program that we call now multi-purpose use of dams, which means we're looking at ways of connecting the neighboring communities to the dams so that they see and the pipes that they also see passing their neighboring communities to some industrial use, like for example, agriculture. We have a groundwater strategy that is currently revising to make sure that we give attention to the areas that do not have water and do not have surface water or sufficient surface water so that we can get that. But actually, if we do not, or basically if we do not step up on our operations and maintenance, including this vandalism, we may find that our efforts are actually reduced. On the issue of dams, Yes, there are concurrency, there are dams that have been designed and there are dams that will still be built according to our strategy and our APP. But in addition to that, we are aware that there are certain dams whose capacity has been reduced by rotation. And so we're looking at how to deal with those situations. But then taking into account the potential and the current impacts of climate change. The dams, we do have flotation in our dams, but with climate change where we are expecting to have high floods, it means that the dams, the frequency and the rate of flotation will be high. Therefore, the current designs of our dams are such that we mitigate for that. In other words, we can avoid flotation. The placing of our dams, remember that you have to choose the dams such that you are able to capture more water. Now we also take into account the issue of climate change. Now the design of the site selection should be such that it's low enough that we also avoid other things like filtration and less capturing of water. He talked about all the efforts that are there in the department or education systems or whatever. But perhaps we need to emphasize that as a department you are continuing to take more intense. Because coming out of a university, you may have the theoretical background, but the technical and the experience you need on the job. And so our learning academy and our internship programs have been intensified for the purpose. I think that I'll stop here and allow our technical team to sort of beef up on some of the issues.
Okay. There is a question that was asked by Honorable Mpunzana. What will happen to areas that we have given water to individuals or that we have agreements with other countries? Perhaps I should start to understand. I should say that we equally are beneficiaries of getting water from other countries. The sort of scheme that we have that supplies most of the reef and assists to supply most of the reef and other areas water that we have from the sort of. We share rivers with many countries. Rivers are shared with many countries. So they would build dams in their countries, we build dams in our country, and we have these agreements that we sign, and we have these commissions that we meet in these commissions to discuss the agreements that we have with countries, and we try and make sure that the agreements we sign, we look after our national interests too. The other countries look after their national interests, but we can assure you that maybe look after our national interests and we try our best to make sure that our interests are not compromised inside in these agreements, just as other nations make sure that their interests are not compromised. But there are rivers that we share with other countries that we have to continue sharing with other countries. So I think this question would equally answer the question Honorable Valindian asked about the Nile River. The Nile River, as you all know, runs through many countries, and therefore, if those countries don't have agreements on how to utilize water, there would be problems. So what we can get the answers on the Nile River, the long answer of it is that the principle remains the same, that all those countries have to discuss the use of the water and sign agreements in commissions that we normally find with countries. I think the other issue that is raised by Honorable Valindiana is the issue of the chairperson of the portfolio committee being involved in the negotiations that we have. I will raise the matter with the relevant authorities. I don't think that is a problem. Parliament is a supreme body in this country, so there should be no problem in having the portfolio committee members in meetings. In fact, I think that in COP17, the way members of parliament that were there represented the portfolio committee. question raised about why the United Nations does not, rather the United States does not want to sign the Kyoto Protocol is a matter that perhaps Chairperson is a little bit subjective in a sense that they think that because they have the majority of the factories and firms and whatever, they would have to contribute more. I don't know. All I know is that they think that we will affect the capitalists in those countries don't really want their factories affected. And I think that they make sure that their politicians do not try this agreement. They don't see what all of us see, that the world is going to run into problems if we don't sign this agreement. And I think somehow we need to find a mechanism to make sure that the American people as a whole understand what a rise in the temperature degrees implies for the world. The United Nations runs a publicity issue in the current on the conference that will be held in September. And it's a chilling address that says to you what will happen at the end of the century if we do not do climate control. And I think more and more we need to make sure that these adverts reach the ordinary people in many countries so that the people can influence the governments that do not want to come to the party. You know, Jefferson, there's one issue that I think our scientists are not doing well, is to simplify the issue of climate change. You need to say to people simple issues. The light becomes warmer. The sea levels rise. So those who live at lower levels will get more water and their countries will get flooded. You know, all those simple things that we talk about when we talk about climate change are the things that we need to make sure that we communicate to the needs of our people so that there's an understanding. And I think in particular that we can help with the Americans in this regard. Honorable Kondo shares the same question on U.S. I think that's about all the questions that we're posing, unless my colleague says another that I didn't answer.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, DDG. I think I just have 2 points. In addition to what DDG said, the issue of Mozambique and other countries sharing of the water at a strategic level. I just want to mention to the members that at our level, at our operational level, as a department, every year we consult with the countries on how we operate the dam and release water, because according to the National Water Act, we are actually obligated to share water with the downstream countries. So we blend them and we find out what is actually sustainable. But that does not answer the question in terms of how people should benefit. I must say that the department is not in a position to say people should not benefit. In fact, the department would like everybody to have water accessible to them. Now, also subject to appropriateness or applicability of a particular technology, our strategy and our policy is for the water mix, not only to look at surface water or groundwater, but also even look at other sources and ways of ensuring that we address the shortage. Of course, not working only as a national department, but working collaboratively with the local government and with the affected communities. That is our position.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Just to give a brief history on the United States, find PetroChina and sell that as a bargaining chip to the Senate, which is still dominated by the Republicans. China, the US sees China as the biggest competitor. And if China is not bound to anything, then this raises the issues of economic competitive advantage. So if they can pull in China, then they think they would be able to convince the Senate to sign up to something. Hence, you will see that the focus of the current administration is to build those relationships. They even have a climate change a platform where they discuss many things, including sharing best practices and going to certain agreements. So we're starting to see that relationship between China and the administration want to use that as a bargaining chip in the U.S. And the U.S. is the one that is currently pushing for a deal when Obama is still in charge, because it's not quite clear what will happen in the next coming election. So they are pushing that by next year. We should be seeing an agreement that they can see through as the Democrats. So that is a brief history on that. But I just want to add that both the U.S. and China constitute 50% of the current emissions. So any deal that does not include the two, it's not even when the paper that is written on. Hence, this push to try and capture the two into the deal. So we'll see. Come 2015, what will happen? That's a big question. However, from where we're sitting, we don't think 2015 is the end. It is the beginning of a process. We think what will happen in 2015 is that we agree to a certain minimum rules as the international community. And then we can start a process starting in 2016 as to the very same process that happened after COP1, the Marrakesh kind of process. A lot of things will be fleshed out between 2016 and 2020, and this four-year gap between 2015 and 2020 is designed in a manner that will flesh out a lot of details, but at the minimum in 2015, the agreement should contain certain amount of rules. And the question of contributions that we are pushing next year for all of us that parties must bring to the table next year is to create a certain threshold. So what is the critical mass? So you want to establish that before you get to edge December 2015. So that's what we foresee will happen after 2015 moving forward. And of course, the issue of bridges and so forth, the whole issue of extreme climate change into a development agenda. And for something like adaptation, it is a bottom-up process. You need what you call the local adaptation plans and so forth. And so you're starting to see the big involvement of local government in processes such as long-term adaptation scenarios. It involves the relevant department and several local government representative, SALGA and so forth, so that you can start that next journey. It's not only limited to bridges, but other things like the road, where you build the road, what kind of road do you build, what climate change imperatives do you build into that. So it's designed to do that. It's a bottom-up process. And internationally as well, you can see that we're starting to involve a lot of local government representatives, particularly organizations, and we're starting to give them a greater platform, because that is where action actually happens. So there's a change in terms of the engagement. In terms of parliamentarians' involvement in the negotiations, I've been fortunate to be involved with the current chairperson in some of these negotiations. There's a forum designed for parliaments all over the world that come together during the COP, and South African Parliament has been participating in that forum, and there will be no change, including this year. The Parliament will be involved there. I think those were some of the questions that were posed. If I missed anything, the chairperson will remind me. But in brief, those are some of the responses.
Thank you. Any last question? Are you fine? Just a quick one from where I'm seated. There is a lot of talk about South Africa being the driest city for the number 13. Also talk
which I'll be seriously running out of water. From where you answered, from environment, perhaps if you can also, do you really agree that we are short of water in South Africa? Yes, madam.
I'll give it a shot. We are not short of water. We are short of potable water. Water everywhere, not a drop to drink. The point is, if we do not change our management strategies to be sustainable, we will be running out of water to fit for use. Nature is not very kind to us. And we cannot afford to, in addition, to be unkind to ourselves. And some of the projections, Chair, are based on models. And of course, these models give an idea of what is most likely to happen, subject to uncertainties. And some of the uncertainties are outside even the control of the climate model, because we do not know how the population is going to increase in future. We do not know whether there will be shift in policies in future. We do not know, but we, our government is doing its best through our department to address these issues. But when they say it's the failure's bias, is when they rank all the countries in the world. That's when they say, unfortunately. Because under natural conditions before we infect the climate change. Now the point is, if there's going to be a change in climate, there's going to be impact on our resources, then the situation is most likely to worsen. So the key thing is we need to use the water sustainably. We need to ensure that water that is, because water that is fit for use, is going to sustain in the future. So that is the main point.
Can I just add to that? One of the other things that we need to consider in this statement is that as much as we are saying South Africa will never run out of water, there's a cost implication to it. Water may be there, but it's going also, if we're looking at options to diversify the mix, to get, for example, clean water, look at options on, for example, desalination. All of these are initiatives that mean for you, the consumer, at the end of the day, you're going to be taking more out of your pocket. So the sooner we start looking at the options of optimizing as best as we can what we have, the later we may maybe say delay the process of getting to that expensive part. So it is really a serious issue in terms of saying, we can sit here and honestly say we will never run out of water, but by the same mouth, that statement simply means we will have water, but if we continue wasting what we have and not making sure that we're taking good care of our resources, we are going quickly towards that stage of getting it to the cost. Thank you.
Okay. Let me round up now. Mama Kaula, I know that Mr. Sharon. Mama Kaula, not at Mr. Sharon.
Thank you, Chair, for...
Mama Kaula, not at Mr. Sharon.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Ibonge, Chair. Mina nana yesu bela bayakuma and put by wola ingozi yedaba eyelete climate change. Owami kumbuzo, uthi khona lento eyenzekayo noma ngizibeka ngokuhlonipisa ngoba afuna sivushela indlevana njengoba hlela. Ile nto yokuthi kubani, lo mbuzo ngokuqhubisa kwelaba baka-environment, kubantu, especially emakhaya kubantu abamnyama ngabe semalokishini, banemuhosha engakhinwa. Amanzi ahamba nje ayihambele, gcwala umaskito, akunakwa, kube nezilwane uma ngabe fika labo abaklinayo bathi bavele bavulele amanzi bathi bona besenza ngokwemitha kuphela kuthiukuthi abantu bahleli lokhuhle ekugcineni ukuthi bankulunkulu idlela amanzamboidlala ukuthi uyahamba zifika lezikhugulahamba kodwa omakhelwane njenga sebenis. Imola ize ikongwe iyavulwa. Ize ikongwe ukuze imibula igeleze ehambi ngani. Uyabona njela ngihlala khona angase ngishuke. Ungabona ukuthi la eSouth Africa thina as abantu bamnyama asinakekeliwe. Ethembeni lokuthi nje ngeke uthole bezakumosha inational. Abantu bayichithe futhi othi laphaya akunakiwe. Noma ngathi shortage ukuthi sifuna kuqashwe. Besicela abadakwethu ukuthi ekesishukumeni kenishukumele lezi ndawo. Bayaphela abantu lapha bemuke lemvula yena yosikhuma ngithenekishanje ngitshanjile. Imvula vele ifike mayithole ukuthi ihambe iyimana. Besicela kule mihosha ivulwe ikhongwe njengakofinishi bakodebhen lona. Hhayi ukuthi kubhekele zuka abantu abamnyama kanti hhayi sokay. Ebenibalikho yiloo nto bengifuna ukwazi ukuthi ngempela yini even emakhaya ngangikhulume ngayo imifula imifula khona isigcine igreen green green njengoba imifula ayinaba iso zonke izinzobe sicela ukuthi njengoba nikhona nakesekele le broad not sibhekele ukuthi uhlaba uthize lolu awulolu hlanga unjani khulumi yena nathi sifuna ukubona imihosha ikliniwe ndiyabonga.
Thank you very much, Chief SNM. I actually realize that we can see the dangers of this climate change. Without being controversial, I'm going to ask a certain question here and I'm going to try to be as diplomatic as possible. In other areas like Phoenix and Denham, we see that there's a specific sewage system that is used where water is able to flow freely. But in rural areas, there's no specific sewage system that are being used. So as water is flowing, sometimes a person is under influence of alcohol, trying to walk past, and as a result, they end up drowning because there's no specific sewage system that is there. In areas like Phoenix, the sewage system, concrete is used, and the water flows easily right through. But in rural areas, this is not done. Why is this the case? And then, even in the location, and in some rural areas, the Mbodi River or in Mapumulo, the water is full of chlorine. Nothing is being done about that water. This sewage system must not be done according to race. It must be done in all areas with all our people benefit equally. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I was just saying thank you for the question that you have raised about the 2020 was to us, you know. But looking at the answer, because this projection comes from the climate change, but it's not about South Africa. It's a projection about Africa. So now, if you look at the answer, yes, we do have a water. But how do you answer the question as for South Africa alone? Because now, to me, that 2020 now, whether we conserve, whether we manage our water resources, but what is the impact if these countries are not adhering to the requirement of the climate change? It's fine that we have water in South Africa, but we are part of that in your slide number 3, where it says by 2020, it's about Africa, not about South Africa. I don't know how can you help me, make sure that we have water, but the impact of these African countries will not affect our water resource management. Thank you.
The man with all the questions. You see, the question I was asking in terms of Makana University with Umama. There it is said that there is no water, or the Sierra water is in shortage. And I'm pretty sure that as we all were to be asked, as we drive out of Grahamstown towards Bushel Friend, you've got a spring waterfall there. And I understand the municipality has even made way for us illegal collection of water. People even come with big cans and they literally throw water and go out.
it is fresh spring water. And I would imagine there are a number of such streams of water throughout the country. To what an extent are we really harnessing and harvesting such? It's something that really fits my imagination. I would imagine by now, I was supposed to have long time ago have had some measures in place of really harvesting some of that water, or most of that water. So not only even our system of municipalities, but are really struggling. You don't even have to use much of any technology. You know, the language these days is your low-hanging fruit. And that doesn't want you to use any technology or measures of such for you to be able to say. And without getting into many other things, you know, that are related to such. But there you have water that can see you drive past, you know, almost daily. And water streams down all the time. If you can hear any comments on that.
Thank you, Chair. Clearly the first one, I'm sure the colleagues from Water and Shine Division will add. But suffice to say that water, like any other natural resource, if you don't use it sustainably, it will run out. But currently, the key problem that we are having in this country is not water availability, it's access to water, and that's different. The chair of the portfolio committee on environment is running this public hearings, and indeed we're hearing the same issues that were raised by Umamare. And I think in his attempts to deal with those issues, he's in contact with the local mayors and councillors, and to see how do we resolve some of these issues. These are fundamental issues, it's true. And these are issues that have been raised in the public hearings when it comes to these issues, but he is really attending to such issues. But as a department, we also have what we call working for programs. One of it is like working for water, where we seek to clean these rivers, get rid of alien invasive species, make the rivers flow so that we preserve the water that we have, and the core benefit is that we create a lot of employment through such programs. Specifically to South Africa, we did what we call long-term adaptation scenarios for this country, not for Africa, but for this country. And we've got clear projections in terms of what will be the impact of climate change for this country. No matter what happens internationally, we've done various temperature scenario projections. So we can tell you if the international community goes this way or the agreement falls short, this will be the impact on South Africa and where exactly in South Africa. And now this is where the Department of Water and Sanitation comes in. Then having looked at that, having mapped out that, what strategies can we formulate? And I think that is what they are trying to do. My understanding is that such a strategy is going to be ready by 2050. But the colleagues can add it. Thank you.
Honourable Chairperson, the question by Honourable Kabula. I will ask the manager, the provincial manager of the department, to look into this issue seriously, because the money that is given by government to local government to do certain things is called MIG money. And it is allocated to local government to build to attend to the water needs of areas, whether they be urban or rural. And we will therefore have to ask them for what is happening in that particular area. We'll come back with some
detailed answer to her in terms of that. What we do as a department too is we have what we call the RB money that we use to assist in building in the various municipalities where the needs are identified. There's a lot of money that is being spent to try and assist in the municipalities. What we need to do is to make sure that we hold these municipalities accountable for the money that are used for water. Because much as they may get money from COPTA or from other people, normally when they do their plans, they have to get approval from us to say, your plan is up to standard and you can continue building and all that. But I do not know the particulars of the area the Honourable Kaula is raising. We will ask you to give us an answer and we will communicate through you with Honourable Kaula. The issue of licensing, which Honourable Jefferson raised about water, certain areas may have people having licenses for water and when they have water in an area. There is a power that through the Water Act is given to the Minister of Water Affairs. So in all areas where such anomalies exist, we were doing a verification process through the DDG planning and information before. And basically, when the study is complete, we should be able to tell which licenses should continue, which licenses should be taken. And in areas like that area where you have a situation like that, we would obviously have to consider the licensing issue. Say, should people continue using water in this manner when people don't have water somewhere else? And then you can either withdraw the license or you can make sure that the license is changed to enable communities to get the water themselves. But licensing is a matter that is within our sphere of control. And in issues that people want to raise issues like this, I think there is nothing wrong with raising them with the department so that we are able to take them up. We will ask again the provincial head of the area to give a more detailed answer to the question raised by the chairperson. The issue that I was raising, that environmental affairs answer that America is changing in the sense that you now have the Obama administration changing. I was simply saying that in 1984, those of you who were involved, and that's what you will remember, when the American Congress passed a decision to say these laws, there were sanctions, and I want to quote the speaker correctly that day, he said, this becomes law, the views of the American president to the contrary. That's how the sanctions were passed in America. The president did not want to sign them. I think it was Ronald Reagan at the time. But the American people took a decision and forced the president to change. So what I was raising was not a position of the department or a position of government. I was simply raising something that was nostalgic to say, it happened, it can happen if the American people get to know what the effects of climate change would be, which is in doubt the power of the nations where it comes to such issues. For the government position, it was just me raising an issue that there is a way in which we can get the country and government to change in the manner in which they treat the issues of climate change.
Did I hear correctly the statement to say those of you were involved in this trial? Was that what you said?
No.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Members, I think that should be it. As has been mentioned earlier on, this is not the first and the last. This is a process that begins. We're looking forward to. I must mention the matter of fact that there is a structure in Parliament on climate change for coordination purposes. An input some troops under structure. It is coordinated within the House Chair Central Front Office. Also that Cyril Cronin is president of one of those organizations that Parliament has been working with. Now we have just established a chapter in South Africa. It's called Globe International. It's one of those bodies that lobby. It's quite a very serious lobbying group on climate change. It's among others. It's located in the UK within the House of Commons in London. Okay, members, I think that should be it for now, and then it's work in progress. As and when, we shall have to look at our program and see how best we reschedule other things. And I must mention as well that, as I said earlier on, there are issues of Millennium Development Goals and post-2015 sustainable development goal issues. So those are all issues that we'll have to take care of as well. UNDP is always ready to assist us together with our work in terms of training, empowerment for us as and when we get into our own discussions here, doing our oversight here, work, so to speak. And of course also when we engage in discussions in other bodies like your IPU, International Parliamentary Union. Those are some bodies that come together with all these other parliamentarians all over the world looking into specific areas, whether it's on climate change or related or other areas for that matter. I saw your hand on the
what we are saying in the
Mr. Gansai, I hope and trust that I'm telling you on behalf of all of us, that those areas, if they can be helped, as you speak, all of those conductors you are referring to, Mama, we will have to make contact with Ubaba as soon as we are done. Thanks for that. Members, we have minutes that we shall have to look into. It's 1 short minute, am I right, Martin? Secondly, there is lunch prepared. And thirdly, next week we shall be having your Auditor General's office come through. Initially, it would have been a session where we prepare for the first college review by the department. Now, having had contact with them, I thought it prudent that we rather have a different session, a session where we get to be empowered about the entirety of that budget cycle. We are now, as we speak, in a session. Parliament is conducting training of PRRs. But the question that you will ask yourself is, how does PRRR fit into the scheme of things, the whole entire budget cycle? So as a result of that, we have agreed that let's conduct that, if you like, some three-hour training session, which is going to be obviously interactive. Your budget office people shall also be available, and then we shall be calling on the CFO or finance people within the department to join, so that we have that one. It assists us so that we have a sense of where what fits where. Because at times you are told, here is your PRRR, as we come back from research, we shall be expected to go through with speed on that budget review process. But how does it fit in the scheme of things? Recommendations are going to be expected out of that. Where do they go? By when? Now, the whole intention of next week shall assist us in that regard. It's a very important exercise, that whole PRRR exercise. I hope some of our members have attended that training. It, among others, empowers you as a member of Parliament to make an amendment to a budget brought to you. Initially, it would have been a smooth process, simply of endorsement by members of Parliament, clearly saying what the executive shall have done simply was to pass through the passage of Parliament, and then it's work that happens elsewhere. Here, what then becomes our role? That's what the PRRR seeks to achieve. With all the recommendations, interacting with the proposition committee, at the end, it is to make it a point that as members of Parliament, we are actively involved in any processes or budgetary process. Then, week after, we shall be expected to engage with the department on the first quarterly review. We have been engaged in a process of discussion. Initially, the plan was to have on the 23rd of September, that must go ahead, an oversight visit in your backyard, Mr. Osman, Madiben. Thereafter, having to be with the entities and department on the 25th and 26th. Now, the other two committees have since requested Agriculture, and Rural Development and Land Reform. They have since requested that we have a joint committee work on stock training. Because of the nature of our work, all of us, as we go forward in our work, we find each other on the way. So, clearly here, a proposal that has since been brought to us, we have had, even this morning, we had to meet to look at some of the logistics. So there, you're looking at the 25, 6, and 7 of September. That is the time Parliament closes or goes for recess, and after which we go out and then come back at some time in October, I can't remember when. But what is being proposed is that we come together, we were discussing where we have done in Cape Town or in Johannesburg. So those are the details that we're working towards. It's quite a very important workshop or training exercise, because it really also empowers us as to how we relate with agriculture and how our work relates with the rural development, and also agriculture, how it relates to water, and how agriculture relates, I mean, rural development relates with, you know, a case in point here, just one example. You also get to hear about this in your outer year. When government is involved in these land reform programs, land being sold by one white farmer to some black farmers, potential farmers, with government assistance, I got to know about this only lately, that the white farmer literally gives away the land, or sells the land, let me put it bluntly, to those black farmers via the state. But it is only land that goes out. Water remains with the white farmer. To an extent, that water, the white farmer literally can trade that water any which way he or she likes. Wondering perhaps, Mr. Guadalajara, as to why a number of these land reform projects have been failing. So this is just for one example. There are many other examples that also Bambuchana will come across with in the course of that exercise. So those are some of the issues that probably we thought we might be to talk about just as we conclude in the day. And maybe before we conclude, we simply take 5 minutes at most, look into our manager. If you are fine with all of that, are we fine? Okay, thank you very much. The minutes, we have them, it is the 27th of August. If anything, that took place at Old Assembly, chamber, and it was a straightforward meeting, a briefing on one specific subject area, fracking strategy and water tariffs. On that first page, all of those that were in that meeting are mentioned there. We have made comments about the style of writing as it relates to apologies section, because somehow it would have been somewhere. What we are seeing differently to some rounds is that it is immediately on the first page. Is there anything on the first page that we have? We also, I was also talking to the committee secretary members about a follow-up on matters raised in the meetings as to how best we deal with that. Because you don't want to have meetings and issues are left behind with those minutes. Usually, you know, the old style of your minute writing would have had an item there on matters arrived, so that we conclude on the text that we should have heard, or the minute that we should have heard. It's a work in progress on that specific area. Oh, it is there. Okay. Okay, I take it that page one is fine. Speak to my mama.
If it is not, and
oh yes.
Something is wrong with Makunyane.
It's not Makunyane.
Mo, it's Mo.
It's M-O-K-O Makunyane.
Okay.
M-O-K-O. Maria is fun, learning. And I can tell the mama that in our next meet, she shall have made a 100% improvement. 100%. Thanks for that. Any further issues on page 1? We are now on page 2. Okay. You.
Reflect the proceedings of the 27th of August, and I correct this message. But now, the paragraph says, matters arising, Mr. Timber, also acting director, and that the department be allowed to respond to some of the issues raised in the Portfolio Committee meeting, which took place on the 27th of August. There's a
20th, eh?
Must be 20th.
20th, yes.
Okay, good.
Thank you. Those are the responses. Fine with that minute. Mama,
I moved for adoption of the business.
Okay. That's being moved. Any
second? Second and the second.
Seconded. Thank you very much for all of that. I'm wondering, members, if there is any further item for us to look into. Now that we've covered almost everything for today. In the absence of any, some then have to declare this meeting as adjourned until we meet next week. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you.